So tonight's fourth illusion is entitled Interdependent Existence. And this is the last talk, but not the last class, on these four illusions. And I think it's useful for me just to start and review them a little, because they really work in tandem with one another, holding together a kind of world that we wish were true. And each of us invest proportionally into that wish, and what we get out of it is our life in its totality, with its discouragement and its successes, but ultimately without a great deal of contentment throughout the process. And the Buddha said that these four illusions were willful ignorance. That is, we maintained a desire not to know what the truth is. We essentially turn away from any indication of what might be different than what we want to believe. And therefore, these views, we invest in them, and they are really inverted truths, truths that are exactly opposite to the reality that we are trying so desperately to hide from. And so what are these four illusions? The first is taking what is impermanent to be permanent, and investing in a life that can assure me some sense of solidarity and continuation, and thinking of ourselves as being enduring through time. So we invest in life to be consistently there when we need it. So that's what it means to take what is impermanent to be permanent. Second illusion is taking what is inherently incapable of satisfying as satisfying. And it's partially built upon the fact that we think happiness can last through an acquisition. And if we move after it, if we just have the right moment, we can actually become satisfied through an acquisition and then have it last into duration. So you can see that this second truth of lasting happiness depends upon taking what is impermanent to be permanent. And so this is a very precarious house of cards, isn't it? So each one is built on the next, and if the wind blows too hard, they start to get very... See that, and everyone here, the wind has blown a little hard sometime in your life, and you're dealing with the ramifications of that by coming to Sims, because life doesn't work when this starts faltering, when our dream doesn't or cannot perpetuate itself. So what is it's also this one about inherently incapable of satisfying. It's thinking that there's something out there that could give me lasting happiness, and that if I just had the right combination, then this sense of happiness could be fulfilled. And yet, many of us can't define what happiness looks like when we are there. And so we're not really sure what it means to be happy, but it looks like other people have it more than me. And I feel a little ashamed or timid to ask what they have that I don't have, because they seem to be holding it together. And inside I feel crumbling, and I haven't found anything in my life that I can rest upon with assurance. But it's a kind of a secret that I want to keep from other people, that I haven't found it, because if I admitted that I hadn't, then what was I saying about how I was living my life? So I kind of protect. It's a kind of inward secret that none of us have really found it yet, but we all like to posture ourselves in a sense that we have. So that's the second. The third one was taking the momentary displays of the world as being continuous. And I had an experience that I was coming back from Austin this weekend, having led a four-day retreat there. And I got to the Austin airport to find that my plane had canceled. The next plane out was in 5 hours, which wouldn't get me to Denver in time to catch the plane that I was taking from Denver to Seattle. So I was missing both planes. So I could see that I could make my time miserable and have in the past, I have to. Or I could make it just so that I never left myself. If I made myself miserable, then I would be wishing myself somewhere other than where I was, wouldn't I? I say, I wish I were home, or I wish the plane had taken off, or I wish I was on board, or I could be, by this time I would have been in Denver. And yet, wherever I would have been, if people could just turn. Yeah, please. But no matter where I found myself, on the plane, or in Austin, or in Seattle, or wherever, I would still be with me, wouldn't I? I mean, I wouldn't be any closer or farther away from me if I were on the plane. And so why not just spend the 4 or 5 hours in Austin with me? Rather than compartmentalizing like there were different me's that were appropriate in this situation, and the me that should be commuting is stuck in Austin. So why fight against that as if we could compartmentalize time and make time work to our benefit by pushing forward into a different time frame? Why not just rest in the time frame we are and not create time at all? Because when we don't create time at all, there is just the present. There's just the present. And the present has different ingredients. Sometimes it's unpleasant present, and sometimes it's pleasant present, but it's always present. And as we begin to learn how to be present in present time, then we don't create time, which is only created when we have a misery within the time allotment of now. And I don't like now, so I look for a future in which now will be better. So the whole thing breaks down, and we begin to see that this constant need to push and fulfill ourselves in some future time, or to try to heal ourselves to some time in the past through our remorse and regrets and lack of forgiveness, really falls flat in this thing. Really falls flat. And it's an illusion that builds upon the fact that if I can just create a future, then I can have the happiness I seek and the pleasure that I need for gratification, and the contentment therein will be available. And I will also allow myself to perpetuate my sense of self far into and through this world by just thinking of myself as going into the future. And therefore I will make myself, the impermanent sense of me, permanent. Which takes us to the last illusion, taking what inherently lacks independent existing as independently existing. Now, this is one that I've brought forth time and time again for this group. It's kind of my basic teaching. But I just want to take it from a different angle. That these four illusions, we have to take them in their entirety. We have to see through each one. They hold up the next and support the next. They condition the next. And so we can't perceive life, okay, well, I'm really into impermanence and I see everything as permanent, impermanent, and yet really believe that life will somehow be satisfactory in its payoff. Those inconsistencies we try to do in Dharma. And what it does is that the whole sense of the fourth one, being independently existing when we're not, thinking we're independently existing when we're not, depends upon the other three's integrity. Continuous time so that I have a future and a past. And because I have a future and a past, I have a goal that I'm going to seek from the from now into the future, which is gratification, or whatever way that we envision an important and meaningful life. And so I need a future in order to try to find that sense of gratification, that lasting sense of gratification or meaning or purpose. That's all the same. But when we start hearing Dharma, one of these might be questions. Like we might think, we hear the Dharma that says, everything is impermanent. Oh, if everything is impermanent, and you can begin to get a sense of that, we don't let it extrapolate into the next thing. Therefore, I can't find gratification in everything. We try to maintain the gratification and see impermanence, and we can't do that. What it happens if you do that is that you get dispirited. You get miserable in your Dharma practice because you've seen half a truth, but you're trying to maintain the other half of the illusion. And you see that everything is changing, but you're still trying to get to that sense of happiness, and so you're having to put an enormous amount of resistance to an insight that you've already had towards something that you think is so meaningful and has such a point and purpose to your life, which is gratification in the future, that you will deny access of that insight into that particular law. You see? And so it's just, we hide. Even when we start opening to the truth, we try to hide some very precious and meaningful movements in our life from that truth. And at some point, we try to uphold the perfect life of me on all four, but to have the perfect life of me, all four of these illusions must be seamlessly true. And then you can have a wonderful worldly life. But how many of us here can say that seamlessly you believe all four of those illusions? Then if you can't, you better start working on all of them. Because you start walking with a cane and then crutches and then you're in a wheelchair, psychically. Because that's the way the Dharma works. And you'll start despairing and saying, oh God, there really isn't any contentment in this world. But we haven't brought forth the full fruition of the insight that there's no me to complain or be miserable. So this requires us moving towards completion of this journey. Because we can get stuck in the Dharma and be quite miserable within it, be quite despairing because we aren't seeing the entire range of what the Dharma is saying. And so I'm going to take this fourth illusion, taking what inherently lacks independent existence as independently existing. And I'm going to just change that to interdependent existence. And I think that's a little easier to swallow than selflessness. Because when we say we're interdependent, we get some feeling, even in a gross sense, that we don't live in isolation to one another. That we are not only dependent upon others for our sense of welfare and our sense of our food and everything that happens, but also psychologically we aren't in isolation. Even psychologically, if you notice, it's impossible not to relate to something all the time, to have a relationship going in our mind all the time. We're constantly relating, even when we're alone or on retreat by ourselves, still the mind continues to run off the reel of its associations, its relationships, or we're relating to our mind and body process, but it's really inherent in life that life relates to itself. And so we see that this interdependent existence is that even for the sense of meaning, everything has to work towards that purpose. Now let me just see if I can back off this a little bit. In Buddhism, they call codependent arising. That is, everything arises from not just one cause, but from multiple causes. Let's say it's snowing outside. The snow arises not from just the fact that the humidity has reached a certain percent, but also that the temperature and other factors, air pressure and other conditions, are all in perfect alignment so that it can snow. And so snow has multiple causes. But each one of those causes has multiple causes that causes it instantaneously. And if you keep looking, you can go out and pan this thing out to such a degree that you begin to see that everything causes everything else. In fact, back 15, 20 years ago, there was a bumper sticker, and occasionally you'll still see it, that says, "I blame everything on the butterfly in Argentina," relating to the fact that when the butterfly flaps its wings, it changes ever so insignificantly, but does change. It's a factor of the weather and how weather, in other words, to be more exact in our forecasting of weather, we would have to know what butterflies are flapping when and what is moving and what currents are being created from all these incidental movements. And so you get a sense that life is a product of itself arising from all factors, all things, immediately. So too is the factor of I, the sense of I. We arise, the sense of I, not just you as a human being, separate from, although you can make sense, as I just mentioned, that you are interdependently connected for your well-being with others and moods, etc. Everything that comes out of you is because of factors that are dependent upon that. But also for the sense of me, the inward sense that I am. That arises from factors as well. And that's really, I think, what more subtly where the Buddha is moving to in this particular allusion. In fact, we try to protect that factor of mind, that sense of me, because it's constantly in movement, because it has to be reshored up moment after moment, because it's dependent upon other factors, and that if we let down our guard, it vanishes. And so what we do as a way to form that illusion and continue to create it is we look for more definition, more ways to define ourselves. Because back in our mind somewhere, we have an inherent sense that if we let down our guard, we would let down the conditions on which the me is arising, and we would, in our worst case scenario, be lost to ourselves. And so we look for further definition of ourself in our life. And one of the ways we do that is to try to find fulfillment in and with happiness. So we begin to see that we need to have the idea or the illusion of happiness as something that I can get and obtain in the future in order for me to have definition of myself so that I can have the happiness once I'm there. And so this need to have happiness continuous is one of the conditions that allows me to continuously arise and to be present as myself, as me. And if I let down any one of these illusions, then I, the sense of me, is thrown off base. And so I just decide in myself that I'm just not going to look at the world. I'm just going to pass it by with some fleeting glance and pretend my way through my life. And it works for a short while, because we begin to see that things are contingent, are in movement, are dependent upon things, and that the whole of life is just a constant movement, a constant flux, a constant transition, contingencies. This is arising contingent upon that, and this is arising contingent upon something else. And all conditions change. And so, what do I do? What do I rest upon? We come to the, what do I rest upon? Well, maybe I can rest upon a philosophy that everything changes. Maybe I can get into Buddhism, now that I see everything's changing, and I can just create a philosophy, everything changes. Very good, except the fact that I'm not allowing myself to change because I'm resting on a philosophy. So that doesn't work either. Now the sense of me has a philosophy that everything changes. I start working the world as if everything was changing, but I am on the outside of that change, looking in at it, noticing it, but being unaffected by it. So that doesn't work. We try to bring our ignorance into our awakening. And through our awakening. But we can only awaken through our ignorance. And so at some point we have to change that sense of me looking outside onto something and bring ourselves into the abiding of in the middle of change itself, to see ourself as changing. And it's an interesting question how we would live if we really brought that attention to bear upon ourselves as having nothing steady or sacred or solid within ourselves. And so we love to think of ourselves as sort of being something, and these laws of life being sort of things that I'm bearing attention to, paying attention to. I'm noticing that there is no happiness in life. I'm noticing that everything changes. I'm noticing how I formulate time. And all of those things, we like to be the scientist who's having the experience, the experiment of life. And we are watching the experiment of life. But some of us, many of us, refuse to enter that experiment, to throw ourselves in and become part of the very thing that is in change. Because once we do so, we see that we are just that, in constant flux. Interdependent existence, interdependently existing. And that's the nature of reality. I never was something. I never was anything. How can this thing ever claim to be fixed when there is nothing in awareness that I can touch that is fixed? And yet somehow, out of seeing nothing that is fixed, everything in transition, I can lay claim to some part of myself that remains beyond that law. It's not logical, is it? Thingness, the sense of me, thingness, dissolves under scrutiny. In fact, things don't change because they never were things to begin with. Change changes. To ever have thought about ourselves as being anything other than a moving stream makes no sense. And everything is a momentary set of conditions which touches other sets of conditions, which are all in constant flux. And what we observe in life and what we observe about life and what we observe ourselves to be is just a pattern, a momentary pattern, like what are those things you look? Kaleidoscopes. And we also realize that when we do make ourselves into a frozen pattern of something, and try to arrest the movement through one of the illusions by forcing one of the illusions, the inverted truths, upon ourselves as being continuous, then we will suffer. Because when you're the only rock in the flow of life, there's a lot of rub. It's only when we're aflow within the flow of life that everything can move. And every form of fixation, every form of solidification, every form of investment as a thing cries out to be released, to come back into its true nature of codependent arising. And peace is not a place or state of mind, but surrendering to that movement. And when we do so, all of the other illusions follow suit. All of them jump in together. And it's interesting because a relationship is a perfect representation of relating, of that movement, of that flux. But most of us do the billiard ball approach to relationship, which means I'm a solid thing and you're a solid thing, and let's find some common ground between these two solid things that we can call our relationship. When actually, the very nature of two people getting together is movement. In fact, we are movement unto ourselves and our surrounds, and this other person is as well, and when we come together, we form a different movement, a different environment for that movement to happen. And the relationship actually becomes a third entity, different than either person individually. Energetically, in all ways, actually, if you've noticed yourself in relationship, what happens is that something else comes out of you that wasn't there in isolation. And for us to be able to give ourselves over to this new creation, this new movement, rather than try to negotiate our individual preferences and our individual likes and dislikes as if we were solid, fixed things coming together in some kind of very touching, bouncing way, is all I can think of. So how do we get to the point where we can acknowledge the fact that we are in movement and that we are not a fixed and separate and isolated thing in ourselves? And essentially, these four illusions, these four pretending fantasies, have to do with the way the mind wants to hold life and secure life for its own use. And when we begin to relate through the heart, through our ability to feel and be affected by life, to let life in, we see irreversibly that when we let life in, that life meets life, our internal life meets that life in absolute perfect synchronicity, because it's all in movement. And now I'm not relating to life as something solid, but life is a relationship, ongoing, continuous, spontaneous. And that spontaneity of life turns into presence. Not me having the experience of, but living, abiding within the experience. And when we think, what are the conditions that allows the conditions for the self to arise, we see that the self arises when I want to stop and pull myself out of that presence, out of that sense of abiding, and act upon life as an object to it. And so then I'll have a desire, And when I have a desire that I form, that I want from life, I have to be outside desiring something from life. I have to have time to complete that desire. So then I bring in the continuous universe. And because I'm not going to chase after something petty, I want something lasting, I think that this desire is really going to give me contentment. So I invest in my ideas to give me contentment, but first I have to create time in order to have the ideas so that I will have a future, so that I can procure the happiness up front. And on we go, juggling the balls of these illusions, each one needing the other to successfully create myself in life, having a nice, wonderful experience that I can enjoy forever. Because you can't have desire without a false belief in happiness. I have to believe that happiness is going to be lasting, will give me something, or why would I pursue it? So my sense of inward desire depends upon the idea that this sense of, once I get this object of desire, once I get and obtain this state of happiness or whatever it is that I'm looking for, there will be fulfillment there. And therefore, there's not fulfillment now. And so I just create that in my mind. I see the possibility of being able to play out, to dance upon life with my desires and go anywhere I want to and frolic. And so I do. It's a tabula rasa, complete blank slate. But all of this depends upon me thinking myself into existence. Now that I thought myself into existence, I have a purpose, fulfillment of my desire, I have time to do it, and I have the perfect and meaningful life to be focused on in my doing. And I have everything that I need for lasting happiness. And again, I just want to reemphasize the point that the Buddha said this was a willful, we are willfully creating this world, willfully investing in a world that doesn't hold any of this. Through our imagination. And as we become serious and begin to actually hold ourselves, the world, accountable for what it really holds. First thing we have to do is train our vision to be able to see what the world actually holds. And once my vision is steadied enough so that I can actually begin to discern and not just pretend, then this whole thing gets very, very shaky. And at some point, I find myself between two worlds. I haven't been able to stop the old world from creating itself and time and pursuit of happiness and thinking of myself into creation. But I also see at the same time that when I do pursue something, it doesn't provide lasting contentment, that it's only a feeling of pleasure, that any feeling is conditional and won't last, and on and on. And so I'm between two worlds and I don't know what to do. And the sense of I now gets very unsettled, very insecure between those two worlds. Because the last of these illusions hasn't really been brought into the mix. Again, I've taken myself outside of these two worlds, having these two different spheres of knowledge, the one of the old and this of the new, this new Dharma view. And yet me, I'm still outside of them. And I have to bring myself in. We have to start including ourselves. How do we start including ourselves? And so we have to, first of all, we do it through sincerity, through really wanting to bring this whole thing into a living experience and not be held outside of it, and not hold ourselves outside of it. all of the phrases and words that we've given over the years, all the Dharma talks you've heard, all the books you've read, it contains the release for this. It contains, the messages are there and have been. Messages like acceptance, allowance, not fighting ourselves, but bringing ourselves into the picture, not hating ourselves, but beginning to embrace ourselves. And through that embrace, we come into the world. When we have kept ourselves at arm's length and distant because we don't like ourselves, we hold ourselves out of the world. But through acceptance, we come into the world, come into the forms and changing qualities of the world. And so we warm ourselves out of existence. We love ourselves out of existence. It also requires investigation, looking at this thing, what is this, but gently. This is not a big radical step. People fear this step of the four illusions, this illusion, much more than the other ones. Impermanence is nothing. Happiness, okay. Time, sure. But me? But the thing of it is, it's if you know one, you know them all. It's not as if there's a whole... It's just a different perspective on the same illusion. And so it's not a huge leap to be able to bring ourselves into this mix. Just begin to question the assumption on which we have been based, that the I is sacrosanct to my looking. Let me just look. Let me just see what this is. Start bringing it into the observation. Question, especially when we're in conflict or annoyed or irritated or grieved in some way, to start going to those places where we are in conflict with something, we begin to see very clearly the ingredients, the way we transform ourselves from nothing into someone. From no one, from nothing into something. Through that rub, because in the rub is where our mind's imagination goes wild, where we create time, where we want to get out of there as quick as we can into the future. And in creating those illusions that there's a moment up ahead in the future that will save me, called happiness, away from this pain, I flower. And so it's from seeing the other illusions that we begin to see the illusion of I. Because the illusion of I creates itself in wanting something, another place, another time, something that will take us out of the misery of the moment. The pursuit of happiness. Thinking that happiness will give me lasting peace. And creating the sense of time from the moment where there isn't any time. And it doesn't mean that we don't honor the life of planning and the life of relationships, physical relationships and mental relationships. We honor the whole spectrum of our life, but we're constantly using every ingredient of our life to be able to come and reach into a deeper understanding of how the whole thing is constructed. What's the scaffolding? How does this thing rise up from the ashes of nothing to create this something, this world of intention and purpose of me and you and all of our noble causes? How does that happen? How does this whole thing develop? Out of nothing. Out of just simple presence. And so, very gently, very quietly, without a great deal of exaggeration or drama, we're always working behind the scenes in virtually every interaction, in every exchange, seeing this phenomena called self and world arise. Out of what? From what? And at some point we get very relaxed and settled within the whole thing, knowing that at any time, yes, we can be functionally ourselves and answer questions about our background, history, birth, and hold at the same moment, hold this sense of complete abiding in life at ease at the Austin airport. Not worried, because presence never goes anywhere. Not looking for a way out of our predicament, because there is no alternative to now. Not seeking some comfort away from now which will give me lasting happiness, because we've gone that, we've finished that now. That's not a viable solution any longer. It's dealing completely with what the conditions are here and now. Sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant. And when we break it down into presence, really all we're ever looking at is sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and thought. Now what is there within that configuration of mental states and sense data that we can't handle, that we have to wish ourselves out of, and which we can't find fulfillment? When we deal with it as it's coming up, as simply as it's arising, it's very easy to deal with. But when we bring in the whole complexity of our narrative and all the things that our life is supposed to be about, then it gets so far afield that we're lost. We have no sense of proportionality or alignment with what is true at all. And so as I keep coming back into the very simple, to the very natural, to the very organic, what's here? What's this right here? What's this moment like right now? And to rest here forever. Thank you. So if we could just sit for a moment or two. As you sit, I would like to read something I intended to include in the talk but forgot. It's something I read by an essayist and humorist who took his life actually in September of this year. His name is David Foster Wallace. And this is a commencement at Kenyon College, commencement speech in 2005. This is what he said. A huge percentage of the stuff that I tend to be automatically certain of is, it turns out, totally wrong and deluded. Here's one example of the utter wrongness of something I tend to be automatically sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence. We rarely talk about this sort of natural basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive, but it's pretty much the same for all of us, deep down. It's our default setting. Think about it. There is no experience you've ever had that you are not at the absolute center. The world as you experience it is right there in front of you, or behind you, to the left or right of you, on your TV or your monitor or whatever. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but your own are immediate, urgent, and real. This is not a matter of virtue. It's a matter of me choosing to do the work of somehow altering or getting free of my natural inclination, which is to be deeply and literally self-centered, and to see and interpret everything through this lens of self. I think we all need each other's help to be able to do this. can see that deep down in each one of us is this burden of self-centeredness. I don't know if you resonated with that, but I did immediately. I thought, oh, of course. The sense that the world is always coming down and aligned into your own experience. I'd like to get more people involved. Get out of the middle of it. And that's what Buddhist practice is meant to do. Is to realign what the center of the universe is. Yes?
Ron, can you talk a little more about the relationship as a third entity?
Yes.
Particularly where you have
yes.
a relationship with someone that's more successful when they're not around.
When I talk a little more about the third entity of relationship. Well, if you don't think of yourself as being fixed, meeting a fixed person, you can see that what you are is kind of a pattern, a swirl. And you bring your moods or your ideas, you bring your performance, you bring your pattern there, in movement, to another pattern, right? And you've agreed to be in proximity with this other pattern, right? Now this other pattern in you energetically form a relationship. And that relationship is actually a third thing, a third pattern separate from each of your energetic expressions. And it's, you can feel it really, because you don't do the same things, you don't use the same words, you don't act as if you were alone and independent, you act as a couple. The couple is this new thing. And for us to be able to concede our individual entity to that couple, rather than to try to hold ourselves and protect our autonomy and somehow allow ourselves to feel fulfilled by being ourselves in a couple, doesn't make sense to me. We have to give ourselves over to this thing and just allow that new expression to be what it is. We've agreed that that person is someone who we'd like to be with to form this new energetic expression. And so we just give ourselves over to that rather than trying to protect. That's not the Western way. The Western way is to protect your autonomy. You know, it's sort of like you do your thing all day long, I'll do my thing all day long, and we'll meet over dinner in the evening. And that's a relationship. But something else is being formed there. And I just suggest, first of all, let's recognize what's being formed there. And it doesn't mean you get your way all the time. And what you thought you should be in a relationship isn't happening here. And yet, it's something else is happening when we are willing to give up that part of ourselves that we felt so proud of and thought we would bring to a relationship, and it isn't coming out or at all, right? Like, Ellen, my wife, is a better carpenter than I was. Could be. I mean, she's... she's like, makes amazing things with wood. And yet, I'm the male here. You know, I should have, you know, I'm the one that builds the ark. but it's like a new thing. So you just kind of, okay, that's it. You just give over to, I'm making this silly, but it actually, in every aspect of our lives, there's something that you're giving over, you're giving up, you're letting some expression of yourself, you're surrendering to some expression of yourself. That's what a relationship does. It forces the surrendering of certain aspects of yourself. And some of us feel the need to do that, which is why I got in a relationship to begin with. I don't want to it feels just too me all the time. And we want a we. We want the me to change into a we. It's what we want to do. Because it's not fun to be a me all the time. At least it wasn't for me. And so we is a completely different thing. And yet it is a thing. But it's in movement. So I don't know how to explain it any better than that. But you have to get out of yourself and not see yourself as being you know, a fixed thing in order to appreciate what I'm trying to say. It's an energy. We're energy. Just energetic patterns meeting, really. And that changes both energy systems into something else. And you can feel that. And then you try to protect. You step back and say, I'm not going to let you do that to me. But it does do that. And so why would I want to protect a particular image or a particular... You just give over to it. And it takes you through all the things you thought you would be and all the things you wanted to be. And virtually you don't come out like any of that. I like the blender. I like being blender, being pureed. I do, because it's like, okay. And then you just kind of, what's left here? Yeah. And what's left is what's important. Everything else was just what I wanted to have or protect or defend or be or, what's left? See, when you want to know what's left, rather than trying to maintain what the illusion is, when you want to know what's left, then you want to know what's true. Because what's left is what's true. And you know what's left? Presence. That's what's left. And that's pure relationship when presence meets presence. Everything else is history and identity and image. Meeting history, identity, and image. You know, are there one other question we can have? Yes.
The part that gets confusing for me is that because, like, I know the experience of sight, and when I see something and hear it, I know my experience. I can only assume you're having an experience. I don't know what it is. So it's not the particulars of consciousness that are so much interdependent as the space.
Is it what?
The spacious. You know, the mystery of it is almost more. And I try to think this.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that way. Yeah. Where you try and wonder what their experiences are and how your experience is going to fit their experience. Just see where you're resisting the experience.
Okay.
And give yourself over to that. Because everyone's configuration of reality is very different than everyone else's. I mean, none of us see the world the way anyone else sees it. And so that is what I'm talking about, because we think of it as being the way I see the world is the right way. And we meet that right way with another person in relationship that isn't seeing it that way at all. And that is what has to be given over. It's our particular view and opinion about the way we see the world. And what I am asked to do of the world and how to meet the world and all of that. That is what has to be relinquished and surrendered. And you can only do that from a counter point of view. You can't do that if somebody met you absolutely identical to your way of seeing it. You wouldn't be any conflict. There would be no rub. The rub is the individual ways that we see the world completely different from each other. And every time we come together with somebody, there's going to be a rub. There has to be. Because they're set. What they act upon and act through, and what acts through them, is very different than what acts upon me and what acts through me.
So what is it?
Presence.
Just
presence. That is the only thing. That is it.
No particular about it.
No. Every particular creates its opposite.
Which is good.